to come up toward the front because we're going to have some interactive discussion, and it will be greatly facilitated if we make sure that we're filling the front tables and not the back ones. So, those who are coming in, we'd invite you to come on up to some of these front tables so that we can have our guest able to connect with all of us a little better. I've got a whole bunch of empty seats here and here and here. So those who have just come in, come on up to the front if you would. We want to welcome you all to this annual joint meeting of the Utah Board of Regents and Boards of Trustees. We thank you for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here. It's always a delight to come to Cedar City this time of the year. We want to thank presidents and legislators who are joining us as well. We hope that the conversations we'll be having today will be helpful and meaningful and give us a great opportunity to talk about some of the pressing issues that are facing higher education here in the state of Utah. We want to especially thank President Scott Wyatt and all of his staff here at Southern Utah University for hosting this event. They've done a lot of work behind the scenes to make it so enjoyable for us to be here, and we appreciate their willingness and eagerness to accommodate us here. A few housekeeping items. The Wi-Fi password is summertime fun, all one word in lowercase, summertime fun. It's the SUU conference, I believe, is the network, but I'm sure you'll recognize it, but summertime fun is the password. Restrooms are located on both floors outside, right here behind the podium. And then finally, for this afternoon, when we have our luncheon, we need your help. We're going to have a facilitated discussion, and we'd like to have kind of an even mix of trustees, regents, presidents, legislators at each table. So regents, we'd ask that no more than two regents sit at each table. Trustees, we would invite you to sit with trustees who are from a different institution than your own. And presidents and legislators, if we could try to keep one president per table, one legislator per table, that will help distribute the brain power that we have in each of these groups. And everyone else, please join any tables you'd wish to join. For several years, as we've come together at this meeting, we've talked about some really important issues in Utah higher education. We're all aware of some of the great challenges we're facing, challenges of growth, which is a high-class problem given what's happening in some places around the nation, funding, access, keeping pace with changes in educational delivery mechanisms, and certainly keeping pace with changes in our economy. We hope that the discussions we're going to have today will help us collectively identify in our various roles some potential next big steps that we can take as we deal with some of these changes here in the state of Utah. A lot of moving parts and interests in our higher education system, a lot of voices, and hopefully we can come together to meaningfully add to the conversation and move this system of higher education forward in a very productive way for the state and especially for the students that we all serve. Today's agenda is divided into three main parts. First, we have the opportunity this morning to hear from one of the country's foremost experts on board governance in higher education. Dr. Kevin Riley comes to us through the Association of Governing Boards, where he's a senior fellow. He's the former chancellor of the University of Wisconsin, which is a 26 campus system, one of the largest systems of higher education in the country, where he served for 9 years as chancellor until 2013. Prior to that, he was with the State University of New York system as associate provost for academic programs. He serves on the board of directors at the American Council on Education. He's also a member of the Higher Education Working Group on Global Issues for the Council on Foreign Relations. Whether you're a new or a seasoned board member or regent, we look forward to getting some pointers and learning some great new things today. After a brief lunch, we have the opportunity to hear from Senator Ann Milner. I think, as most of you know, Senator Milner is the co-chair of the Higher Education Strategic Planning Commission that the legislature established a couple of years ago. She'll be providing an update on the commission, including some preliminary findings of the consultants working for the commission. And following her update, we'll have a facilitated discussion on the future of higher education by Dr. Kim Wheatley. We hope this fosters some robust discussion that will inform the efforts of the commission as they wrap up their work. And as I mentioned, we'll be able to help identify issues and get conversations going that will help be helpful to them in the agenda that they create for us going forward. So again, thank you all for taking the time to be with us, and I'll turn the time now over to Dr. Riley. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that nice introduction. I am delighted to be here with you, and I have a little bit of past history with this part of the state. I was telling your interim chancellor and Spencer that I, and some others on the phone, Liz, that our youngest child and youngest son wound up attending the Discovery Academy in Provo for 2 years of high school, and then also did the Red Cliff Wilderness Ascent program out of St. George. So I have winter camped, slept on the ground in the middle of winter in the mountains outside of St. George. So I think I ought to be at least an honorary Utah citizen after having done that. So it's nice to be back in this very beautiful part of the country. I'm going to try to do this a little less formally than being up there. As long as people in the back can see me, and if you want to move up, you can. But I think we're okay, got sight lines. So let me say a few words of introduction as we start. And let me say to the regents and the trustees, by way of start, thank you. We probably don't say this often enough to the people who play these roles. You know, you when you step up into these jobs, you put yourself in the line of some slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You make some decisions that people won't like, and you hear about that. When I was president of the University of Wisconsin system, when the regents there would take a tough decision, I'd regularly get texts, emails, sometimes phone calls, Twitter. I get tweets from people saying, "Why don't you fire those regents and cut their salaries?" And I'd have to get back and say, "Well, as a matter of fact, I can cut their salaries. Half of zero is zero, so we'll cut their salaries in half. And you know, they hire and fire me. I don't fire them." So people don't understand, by and large, what you do. Those of us in the academy do, and we really are grateful for it. When I was thinking about this today, it put me in mind of what one of your former governors, Mike Leavitt, used to say, which was public service is full of people who did not know what they were getting into. I think there's a lot of truth to that. So my focus today is really going to be on fundamental roles and responsibilities of board members of various kinds in higher ed. Let me see if I can get this to move. Oh, seems to be, maybe I have it the wrong way. Let's try that. There we go. So basic roles and responsibilities, kind of the do's and don'ts of governing board membership. I've seen your document that lays out the different authorities that the regents have from the institutional trustees. I'm not going to be getting into that much today. I'm really going to stay at that level of fundamental roles and responsibilities of boards generally. So having said that, though, your two-tiered shared governance structure in Utah undoubtedly frames how you think about governance. And as we go along, if questions or thoughts arise about what I'm saying about fundamental roles that relate to your structure, let's get them on the table and have people talk about them. I'll divide what I have to say into three parts today as well. First, some hallmarks of effective boards. Second, the difference between governance and management, or the difference between the transactional and the more strategic, and then third, board advocacy. And we'll have some time after each of those sections for comment and discussion by you. It's a big group, but let's try to keep it as conversational as we can. I'd like to let the focus be on where you want the focus to be among these hallmarks. And the first section on the hallmarks will be the longest one, then the one on management and governance, second longest, and the third on board advocacy, relatively short. So as your attention wanes, we'll be kind and make the section shorter. And we do have some flexibility in the schedule, especially when we get to the management versus governance part. We don't need to go through all the paired questions that you'll see on that. We can focus on some and not on others. If we want to spend a little more time on the hallmarks up front, we'll do that. And one final thought. So what I'll present to you today is kind of the accumulated wisdom of the Association of Governing Boards of Universities and Colleges about what constitutes effective boards, leavened a bit by my own experience. But in saying that, I'm mindful of what Tip O'Neill used to like to say, which is all politics is local. And what Rick Ligon, who just retired after as the president of AGB after 36 years with the organization, 14, I think, is the president, the last 14. Rick always liked to say, if you've seen one board, you've seen one board. So I'm mindful that some of these hallmarks that AGB has come up with and that I'm promulgating today, you may say, well, you know, that might work well in Wisconsin, Kevin, but here in Utah, that really won't work, or that needs to be thought of differently. So if you're feeling that as we go through these, speak up. And then let's say, well, what's the parallel hallmark that works in Utah to the one we're talking about here from AGB? So all that make sense? Any suggestions, redirections? Commissioner, where are you? Is that blow ahead? Okay, we'll do it. We'll get started. Here we go. So the first one, and this is from a publication that AGB put out a couple years ago on consequential boards. An effective board understands and respects the vital difference between governing and managing, and it nurtures and supports presidential commissioner leadership. We'll talk more, as I said, about that management and governance division along the line and why it's important to try to keep it distinct, but why sometimes it's not as distinct as you might want it to be or think it should be. But let's focus in this first hallmark on the second part of it, nurtures and supports presidential commissioner leadership. So I think that choosing a president, choosing a commissioner who's the right fit at the right time for the institution or the system is arguably the most important thing you do as regents or trustees. And I'd also argue that today no university president or system commissioner comes to the job with all of the skills he or she needs to do it well, fully developed. It's just too hard a job. I was president for almost 10 years, as your chair said, at Wisconsin. I was a chancellor in the system, an institution before that. And I've been out about 5.5 years now, and as I watch what's gone on, the job has just gotten harder and harder. And I thought it was telling in that regard that when Bill McRaven, Admiral William McRaven, who was the chancellor of the University of Texas system, was leaving after a fairly short tenure there, after 3 years, and most of you will know Admiral McRaven was Navy Admiral. He was the head of Special Forces. He put together, developed, and carried out the mission that got Osama bin Laden, and he said when he was leaving that job in Texas, these are the most difficult jobs in the country now. Now, who are we to quarrel with Admiral McRaven on that? So how you select and then support the leadership development of your president, of your commissioner, is really, really an important part of what you do. And this hallmark gets at it. And some of you will know the work that Jim Collins has done, has written leadership books, mainly focused on leadership in the corporate world, and he's got a number of them. And not usually a great fan of those books, but he's really worked hard with a cadre of graduate students, done a lot of research on effectiveness in those jobs. It's not just interviewing people and having them say, well, let me tell you how effective I was as the president of X. So I think there's a little more credibility in his work than in some of them. And he's got, in the Good to Great book, he's got five levels of leadership, some of you will know, and the fourth, from kind of lowest level to highest, the fourth is the charismatic leader who really gets things going, comes in, does great stuff, but then when she or he leaves, it all kind of goes away because it was all about the charisma of that one person who is there while they were there. And when they're not there, that sort of fades out. The fifth level, which is the highest level, which he admires most, are leaders who build value into their organizations as they go along, value that's out beyond them, that's not reliant on their presence or their personality alone. And that value stays in the organization after they leave. That's his fifth level. And he quotes a business executive that he put at that fifth level saying what I thought was a great thing about these kinds of president, chancellor, commissioner jobs. The person said, I never stopped trying to be qualified for the job. And I think you can never feel fully qualified for these jobs now, given their difficulty. But part of the trustees and regents' role is to try to figure out how to help your leader be as fully qualified as she or he can along the way. Second hallmark, an effective public board always balances the institution's interests and welfare with the needs and priorities of the state, the institution's interests and welfare and the state's. So as I see you all on boards of trustees and regents, you're kind of the innie outie group. You know, there are two kinds of belly buttons, right? Innies and outies, and you're both. Or another metaphor for where you sit is you're kind of border runners. You sit on the border between your system and the wider society, between your institution and the wider society. You bring news, desires, criticisms in from across the societal side of the border. You bring news, hopefully mostly good news, out about what the institution's doing to the societal side. So it's that kind of a job. And you are the people who can remind the institution when it needs to be reminded that it's not all about the institution. And some of us, you know, who lead institutions get so focused on the health of the institution, and we need to be very often, that sometimes we need to be reminded by you that, okay, that's great, but let's see what the institution needs to do for the wider world. And at the same time, you need to be really good fiduciaries of those institutions, right, so that they can function without undue interference to meet their current mission and be around for generations to come. The sustainability issue is really important for future generations of Utah residents and others to enjoy and profit from. So another metaphor I like to use about this border running activity you have is you're kind of like a control panel in a heating system. You know, sometimes the panel needs to be more or less shut and you're buffering the heat that's coming in from the outside because it really is kind of undue interference and you need to stand up and again take some of those slings and arrows from people on the outside who are saying, tell the commissioner to have them stop doing this. Tell the president not to have that program anymore. Tell the president to fire that tenured faculty member. And you need to say, no, let me tell you why that's not a good idea. At other times, you need to sort of open that panel a little bit and let some of that heat in so that those of us on the inside of the institution say, ooh, well, we're really not responding as well as we need to the needs of the society. And that's a criticism we need to pay attention to. And you can uniquely bring that criticism in hopefully a relatively plausible way and kind of as a loving critic role kind of way, right? So I think to think about is, you know, are you regents, are you trustees in Utah serving as the buffer at the right time and the conduit at the right time? And how do you get that right? And it changes from, you know, day to day, week to week, how you need to play those two roles. And an interesting topic of discussion, we won't have really time to do it today, but would be a discussion with the presidents and their staffs. with the commissioner and his staff about whether they think you're all playing that role in the right way at the right times. Third hallmark of effective boards. An effective public board balances advocacy and oversight. And this really is a little like the conduit and buffer balance that I mentioned. So I once invited the Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly to come in and talk to the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin system. And he said to them, I don't want you to be advocates for the university. I want you to be advocates for the taxpayers of Wisconsin. Quote, I mean, directly, that's what he said to them. I'd argue that effective board members are both. And that's what makes the job tricky to do well. And where, let's see, I know you have a student board member on the Regents. Where's the student board members? Back here. And you have students on the trustees as well? All right, good. So for your students out there who are currently Regents or trustees, the Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, Scott Voss is his name, is a former student trustee on the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin system. So your pathways are unlimited for all you students on boards. But at any rate, I think getting that balance again right is something you need to think about and talk about among yourselves and with your chief executives and others on their staffs. And we'll spend a little time at the end of the 2 hours this morning talking about this Guardians Initiative, which is about more board members engaging in advocacy in the public realm than we've called on people to do before. Not that you're not busy enough with all you do for your institutions already. And again, as we go along, if you have questions or thoughts, stick your hand up and we'll stop and chat. So, fourth hallmark, an effective board observes and imposes the highest ethical standards and avoids even an appearance of conflict of interest. So this is about the university system or the Utah system of higher education's reputation. It takes a long time to develop a positive, highly regarded reputation in higher education, and it takes a long time to get it back if it gets damaged. So I think always in the back of your minds as trustees and regents, you ought to have the Hippocratic Oath. You know, do no harm. Whatever else you do, do no harm. Hopefully you do a lot more than that. And in thinking about that, for each of you on boards, does your board have a clear, effective policy around ethical behavior, what you should and shouldn't be doing? Do you talk about it once in a while? And when you have a problem, can it be called on and brought to bear on what the problem is? And you know, this is a number of these hallmarks, people might say, oh God, of course, that's obvious, isn't it? Be ethical. And it is obvious that it's the right thing to do, but it's so easy kind of to slip off the ledge on some of this stuff. So I recently was working with a very highly regarded public university system, some of whose board members were also on the university state health system board. So in this state, they had a public health system board that had the name of the university in it, University of X Health System, and some of the board members who were governing the university were on the university board were also on the health system board. So it came out that a number of the people on the health system board had no bid contracts with the health system that had not been made public. And these were with their own companies. They were making money off the health system that they were supposed to be objectively governing. The newspaper broke this story, and when it came out, the chief executive of the health system said, well, we have to do this, otherwise we couldn't get any good board members. He was gone in 2 days. And now the university is still struggling with a reputational hit because some of its board members had those no-bid contracts in their other related role as members of the healthcare system board. And again, this is a system that has a very positive reputation in history. So this is just kind of eternal vigilance on this issue. Do no harm. An effective board, even when sharply divided, speaks with one voice. So I'd say here, no one board member, no group of board members is the board. The board is the board. And the chair of the board, or his or her designee, speaks for the board. Now, is that right? Anybody think that's wrong or needs to be modified? Somebody? Anybody? I think it does raise a tough question, though. So if it is right, how do other board members beyond the chair engage with media with your myriad stakeholder groups? How should other board members do that? And, you know, again, this is a local culture issue in some ways. In some instances, other board members are doing more of this. I think it's a dangerous game, especially if the media starts to think that you are, when you're not the board chair, you're speaking for the board, because by definition, you're not. The board chair needs to be speaking for the board. And sometimes it's really hard to say, love to talk to you about this, reporter, Mary, but I'm going to have to send you to the board chair to talk about it, because he's going to be the spokesman for this, or the spokesman for the system or the institution or the commissioner or the president. But that's, in most instances, I think, good practice. That's what you need to do. And why? Well, because if you start to speak with multiple voices, or members of your board are putting out mixed messages that may seem to contradict what the rest of the board is saying or your chief executive is saying, then it all gets to be a muddle and the institution doesn't move forward. It moves backwards and forwards. It moves sideways, and you don't make the kind of progress that you need to make. And we'll talk a little more about board dissent and tough discussions as we go along here. But I still think that is a pretty good hallmark. Number six, an effective board listens to and learns from the institution's constituency without giving any of them a veto. So in my experience, when you think about the many constituencies that you have with a university or university system or community college, there are probably some firsts among equals among the constituencies. It's a thing of what the Pope likes to say about the Pope among the bishops, you know, primus inter pares, first among equals. And some of them you probably feel you need to pay more attention to, or you do for various kinds, for various reasons. And I don't know if you have that feeling here. We could talk a little bit about that, who your first among equals are. And this raises an interesting question, too, about should board members meet or talk privately to members of various constituencies? Is it okay if you're a board member and you call up the chair of the English department and say, gee, my neighbor's son is in that James Joyce course and he's really not enjoying it. I don't know what's going on with that professor. On the other hand, you often want to legitimately have contact with faculty and students and staff and alumni and athletes maybe and others at the institution, right? So how do you avoid undue, improper contacts that can lead to trouble and still feel like you are getting to know your institution and the people who serve it well? Again, a thing that I think you need to think about carefully. I'll give you one example of how we tried to do it. Not that this was perfect, but I think it helps. So we had a thing in Wisconsin we called the buddy system, the regent buddy system. So every year, the board chair and I would assign a regent or two to take a special interest in one of the institutions in the system and work with the chancellor. In Wisconsin, the chancellor is the head of the individual campuses in the system. So work with the chancellor and get to know the system and visit and get to know students and faculty and staff. So that was kind of a charge that the board chair and I gave them, really the board chair gave it to them. But then I would say to them, okay, when we come back to evaluate this chancellor next year at the end of the year, when I'm sitting with you in closed session and we're doing the performance evaluation on the chancellor at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, if you've been one of the buddies to that chancellor for the year, I'm going to call on you and have you talk to your peer board members about what you found out about the University of Wisconsin-Parkside and how effective that chancellor is as a leader based on some new, deeper knowledge than you might otherwise have. So the virtue of that was it kind of formalized an ability of the board members to get to know an individual institution, and we change it up every year. So there are 7-year terms, and in the course of their terms, they'd be assigned to different campuses and get to know different chancellors. But we made a point of saying, you know, what you're finding out, we want to learn about at the system board level. I want to hear about it as the president. Generally worked out pretty well. Ways to do that without giving any constituencies a veto and without having private conversations that the leadership of the system or the institution doesn't find out about till 4 months later is the trick here, I think. An effective board nurtures and enhances the legacy of the institution. So I think there are two nagging questions that ought to be in the back of your mind as a board member all the time. One, what do you see the institution being in 10 years? What do you see it being in 20 years? And two, how are you working to get it there? What do you see it being in a decade or two? How are you helping to work to get it there? There's a guy by the name of Richard Chait, who's now emeritus professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, who's written a lot and well, I think, about board governance in higher education. And Chait talks about three gifts that board members can bring to their institutions. And I think these gifts are sequential. But the three gifts are oversight, insight, and foresight. And so I think they're sequential because when you first come on a board, you really have to ramp up the oversight thing, right? You've really got to learn about that institution or about that system in your first year or two and find all sorts of ways that you can do that. As you get more of that under your belt, you can start to bring the insights from your businesses, your professions, your walks of life to bear on the institution. And that, by the way, is one of the great things about lay governance of American higher education, is that you all bring these perspectives that we don't have, because most of us have been in the academy for our careers, and we want that. So, and by the way, maybe most of you know this, maybe some of you don't, most of the world doesn't operate this way in their higher ed systems. They don't have lay governance. We have a fairly unusual tradition of that, of people from outside the academy being the final decision makers about what happens inside it. And I think it's served us very well. And for all our challenges, as I think you know, we're still the most admired higher education system of any countries in the world. And I was talking to one of your colleagues here about all the international students you have here at Southern Utah, from Saudi Arabia in the past, more China, more now, and some other places, the Congo and elsewhere. And that's because we've been able to maintain that reputation. And part of the ability to do that has been the lay governance model that we have. So you get to that insight, and you can bring that in once you know something about the institution. And then you get finally, hopefully, to that foresight gift, right, where you know a lot about the institution, you're bringing your insight to it from your own profession, and combining those, you're able to help look over the next mountain and the mountain after that and the third mountain out to help look forward. And that goes back to what I was saying about the nagging questions, right? What do we want this institution to be 10 years from now? What do we want it to be 20 years from now? There's another set of three gifts that people sometimes talk about board members bringing to their systems or institutions, and they are the three W's: wit, wisdom, and wealth. And so some people will in the profession will say, well, it's, you know, if you're a little light on the first two W's but you're heavy on the third one, that's okay, we'll let you go on that one. Number eight, an effective board recognizes its special responsibility to students for the quality and value of their educational experience. So I think this is a way of saying it, you know, it should begin and end with the students. They're kind of the alpha and the omega of what we're all in this room for. And, you know, the research function is really important, outreach is really important, but finally, if students are not getting a good education at your institution or in your system, you're failing. We're all failing. So it's good to remember that. And it's interesting to think about this question, I think, now. And you have some, fortunately, again, students in the room and students on your boards. How does the Utah student now think about what constitutes a quality, valuable education for him or her? What do the consumers think about now? And part of the reason that's an interesting and difficult question is we have become such a huge enterprise, higher ed has in this country. So when I was in college almost 50 years ago, now there were 6.3 million American undergraduates. We now have almost 20 million American undergraduates. So the growth has been quite phenomenal. And with that growth has come a much wider variety of students, much more diverse students who have come to us with a whole wider range of expectations and needs and desires and aspirations and economic backgrounds and racial and ethnic and gender backgrounds. And you can't simply say we've got kind of a monoculture here and we know how to serve them anymore, by and large. Some institutions still can say pretty much that, but boy, they are in the real minority now. So let's think about how you think about that. I like to talk about three different kinds of students. So student A wants to come to Southern Utah University right out of high school, study history, be in the band, go to the football games, be in student government, climb the rock wall, do all the things that residential 17 or 18 year olds when they arrive might want to do in a college campus. Student one. Student two is a 26-year-old male who's got a high school diploma. He's been out since high school working in a pretty lousy, low-paying industrial job, doesn't see a future there for himself, and wants to go back to school and get an associate degree to prepare him to work in the video gaming industry. Wants to do software for video games. Don't we all? I'd like to go back and do that, I think. Third student is a 38-year-old single mother in Provo. She's got two kids, she's got a house mortgage, she's got a dog, and she needs 20 credits to finish her Bachelor in Business Administration so she can rise into the supervisory and eventually she hopes management ranks at her company. What do those three students have in common about what constitutes a quality education? And what do they have that's different? As I think about that question, it's kind of like a Venn diagram where, you know, you've got overlap among those three students about what constitutes quality for them. And in that overlap, that circle part of it, is really about having really good faculty who know their discipline, who are interested in teaching it, can teach it well, and are concerned to know whether their students are learning it or not. That quality equation applies to all three students. But a lot of the other things they want and need out of their higher ed experience will be different. And we need to be able to serve them all. So as we think about that fundamental obligation to students as board members, we need to think about the different kinds of students we now serve, especially in a system like you have here, where you have different institutions that are avowedly serving different students with different missions. Nine, an effective board represents and advocates for the institution in the larger community. So this is the board member grocery store duty, right? When you're out shopping on Saturday morning and somebody comes up to you and says, I want to talk to you about what's going on over on the campus there, and you need to be willing and able to do that. An interesting particular to think about this in effective representation and advocacy with the larger community is, how do your public board meetings fit into this? And, you know, you're all public institutions, so we have to, your board meetings are public and you operate with your freedom of information laws and your open meeting laws in this state. We all hope, right, that the board meetings have informed and engaged and honest and free-flowing discussion. But those board meetings are also about what messages you want the media who are there or listening or watching to send out across the state or across your region of the state after that board meeting about what you say. Are you thinking enough with your president, with your public relations vice president about what the message of each board meeting is and how you can control that, but also in an open public atmosphere? And this gets back to the issue we were talking before about, you know, what do individual board members do with media and how should you interact with them? And on the one hand, you don't want to just have everything set, fixed, and come in and it looks like you're rubber stamping everything that comes before you and then you leave and go home for the weekend. On the other hand, you don't want every issue to be a knockdown, drag out, nasty, personal, contentious fight in front of everybody. Somewhere, obviously, between those two things, there's a happy medium. But I think more and more the public institutions especially need to think really strategically about each board meeting as an event, an opportunity to send the messages they want to have sent as a group working with their commissioner or their president out to the wider public. Number 10. Effective board commits itself to the institution and to the process and to due process and academic freedom for faculty and students. So due process and academic freedom play out differently in the university than they do in other places. They certainly have due process in other kinds of organizations. Academic freedom is kind of a unique creature. But Gerhard Casper, who was president of Stanford University a number of years back, used to say when he had new board members come onto his board at Stanford, especially if they were from the business world, some from government too, would kind of feel like they were the American who flies into Heathrow Airport and needs to rent a car. And he goes to the car rental spot and he's looking at these cars. He looks and he says, the wheels are all on the wrong side. And then he gets in the car and he's driving the car. He gets to the end of the parking lot. He's got to go out in the road and he's looking both ways and they're driving on the wrong side of the road. Right? It can kind of feel, I think, to people from outside the academy when they first come into a position like a regent or a trustee, like these people have it all wrong. I mean, they do it all ass backwards, right? What's wrong with these people? It's not wrong, it's just different. It has its own strengths and weaknesses. It's not business, it's not the military, it's not government, it's another kind of creature. And how you as board members, as governors, deal with that difference, especially on issues like due process and issues like academic freedom. And God knows those are hot issues now, especially the due process one with Title IX and sexual assault and sexual harassment. I mean, I've had presidents who I think very highly of who are experienced presidents say to me, I don't know how to handle this. I just know that whatever I decide, I will be creamed in public by one side or the other. And that's true. That happens to be where we are. So helping your president to work through that kind of issue. And the academic freedom one, also very difficult. And I know that often those issues tend to occur more perhaps on the R1s or the bigger campuses, the research campuses. But often what happens on those campuses, especially if you have a system, is rolls down over all the other campuses and institutions in the system because people think, this is what's going on in higher ed. They bring these crazy people to come in and talk to the students about this crazy stuff and they're horrible people and they put them in front of the students. What's wrong with higher ed? Now that may happen, you know, once a year at 1% of the institutions, but people see the whole creature that way. So it's really important, again, that you work with your chief executive on those kinds of issues. And these are issues where very often it's going to be uncomfortable for you. You may find you have a personal belief system that doesn't match the belief system of a speaker who's been brought to campus. You may hate the ideas that that speaker is talking about. But at a university, as a board member, it's your obligation to say, I disagree profoundly with what that person's saying, but we're going to give that person a forum to say it at the university. We're going to have other people who think differently. We're going to bring other speakers in later who think differently. That's what a university is and does. And that's where it can be a tough job. Another place it can be a tough job. So, final one. And this is really soft, isn't it? Come on. Commit to adequate time and energy, not only to its basic, but to the enjoyment of the board experience. Why do you need to tell us that, Kevin? Well, it is a soft hallmark, but I think it's kind of an important one too, because boards are at some level social networks, right? They're networks of people who are doing important, difficult things, and they can't do those important, difficult things as well as they should if there isn't some level of trust between the people, personal trust and appreciation between the people on the board. So again, effective boards know that, and they think about it, and this is especially the chair's job in some ways, and they know when they're coming up to discuss a topic where there's going to be dissension on the board, where board members have strong and opposite feelings about an issue. They think about, all right, how do we structure this discussion once we've taken a vote? And some people are not going to be happy with that vote on the board. They're going to be in the minority. How do we go back and sort of repair the rifts? How do we solve the wounds that have developed? Thinking about that's really important, because if there is no trust among board members, if there's no trust between the board and the chief executive, things don't work well. They just don't. And, you know, speaking as a former chief executive, with the chief executive, if a lot of the board feels that way, you can fire the chief executive. But for the most part, you can't fire your fellow board members. You've got to figure out a way to move along and move ahead and move the institution ahead with them. So we'll talk a little bit about culture, which we've been talking about all along, and then we'll stop and open it up for comments and questions. So Gertrude Stein, who you know some of you know is an experimental American writer who lived in Paris at the beginning of the 20th century, used to say culture was how we do everything around here, which is kind of a pretty good simple definition of what culture is, I think. One that's more pointed toward higher ed governance culture, a smart person I think once said, the main differences between high and low performing boards relate to the governance culture. The pattern of beliefs, traditions, and practices that prevail when board members come together to perform their duties. The pattern of beliefs, traditions, and practices that prevail when board members come together to perform their duties. That's kind of a good definition of culture for trustees and regents. And this tries to get at what's a healthy version of that and what's not through some examples. So the healthy version is it's a team. People are working with each other. They have sometimes different roles. They don't always all agree with each other, but they see themselves as a team driving toward the same goals on behalf of the institution, on behalf of the students, on behalf of the people of Utah. The unhealthy version is the huddle of quarterbacks. You know, if everybody on your board always thinks he's Bart Starr or Aaron Rodgers, it's not going to work. It's just not going to work. Distributed influence on a healthy board versus a dominant inner circle. And this dominant inner circle problem can get more intense the bigger the board is. So I know with the regents, you've got 17 members. How big are your trustee boards typically? 10. So they're kind of medium size, not huge, but not small either. And I think finding ways so that all board members feel they're part of the effort. And even if they're not on the executive committee, even if they're not a board officer at any one point, but that they're listened to, their work is appreciated, is important in that regard, so you don't develop that dominant inner circle and other people feel outside of it. Again, one thing that we did, which seemed to help break some of that cycle, and we were getting a little of it at one point with my board, and we had 18 members of the Board of Regents in Wisconsin, was the board chair and the board vice chair and I, the three of us, before every meeting, would call a third of the other board members. So we would individually divide, we'd divide the board up, and then we'd individually call a third. And we could do that under the open meetings law without violating it. It wasn't too clear that if you we called, you know, three of them at the same time and had a conference call, you probably have this issue of whether it's a walking quorum and you're violating the open meetings law. But it was clear that if we did individual conversations and no decisions were being made, we could do that. So we each called that third, and we'd say to them, okay, you got the materials. What's on your mind about them? You know, what's troubling you? What questions do you have? What questions do you have that you might not want to ask in public at the board meeting that I can help you kind of talk through here so you can be prepared to ask the ones in public that you want to ask? And what do you think about the issue? And then after we did that, the chair and the vice chair and I would have a conversation saying, what did we hear from all the board members? And before every board meeting, we'd rotate. So we'd each talk to a different third, each of the before each meeting. And that seemed to help to get people, everybody feel like, wow, they're reaching out to us. Our ideas, thoughts, concerns are being taken into consideration. Some way to do that's really important. Collective wisdom versus individual convictions. You know, Socrates' definition of wisdom was, you know what you don't know. It's a little like Donald Rumsfeld with the known unknown. Remember that? I hesitate to mention Socrates and Donald Rumsfeld in the same sentence, but so you know what you don't know, and that gets to the issue of asking questions. I think, you know, one of the most effective things good board members do is they ask good, informed questions that are timely and pointed, they don't just come on with their convictions and say, "Here's what I believe we ought to do." They ask questions to get at why the institution's doing what it's doing and if there are other alternatives that might make more sense. And that's the collective wisdom approach as opposed to individual convictions. Listeners versus assertive speakers. I think that connects back to the good questions. Good listeners are the ones who generally ask the good questions. Constructive dissent versus back channel sabotage. There are times when all of you will be uncomfortable with a decision the board has taken, or it'll be amazing if there's not, if you stay on for any period of time. Then the question is, well, do you go public and say, I really don't think this was a good decision because X, X, and Y, or this was the wrong decision because X, X, and Y? I'd say if you're going to have a healthy culture, you don't. You can say to people, look, I took the other side. But the board in it, we talked it through. I had a fair chance to put my position out on the table. The majority of the board voted the other way, and I'm going to back them because that's the way an effective board works in the interest of the institution. And you don't have that back channel sabotage. Transparency, in the public sector, really important, obviously, and driven by law and regulation very often. And you want to avoid that sense that you're trying to obfuscate things. And sometimes on delicate matters, it can really be hard to figure out how to be transparent, but not violate the next recommendation there, which is there are some things where confidentiality is required, and leaks then get to be really bad and undermine trust. You know, there's nothing worse sitting around a board table, right, when something confidential has been leaked, and everybody's looking at everybody else wondering, all right, who did this? Who put that out there to the press? That's not good for trust. Diligence versus disengagement. I mean, if you get what I used to send out to my board members, you know, before every meeting, you kind of get what something the size of the old Manhattan phone book used to look like dropped on your desk, and you've got to go through it. It's really hard, but keeping up with the materials is your obligation. And mutual accountability versus collective impunity. This isn't we hide behind each other. This is we made this decision. We're all accountable for it. And let me tell you why I think it was the right decision. Or let me tell you why if I really disagree with the decision, I still think we need to do it because the majority voted this way. So that's about culture and hallmarks of effective governance. And before we go on to management versus governance, let's stop there and see what you all think. Questions, disagreements? Did I say anything that doesn't seem like it fits in Utah, although it might fit in other places. Anybody? Over here. Yes, sir. And speak up if you can so people can hear.
Hopefully, if you can't hear me, raise your hand. I don't know how you know that I'm not here. One of my concerns, as you say, it's hard to be a president, but it's hard to be a board member. And I worry a lot about there are a lot of students, and they can do dumb things, get in the headlines and all that. There are a lot of faculty, there are thousands of students, hundreds or thousands of faculty, hundreds of staff or thousands of staff, and the challenge is, and you, one of the items you talk about was high ethical standards and avoiding conflict of interest and so on, but the part of the question is, how can the board know about some of the, and we talked about risks earlier in the audit meeting, but how can we know about the risks? University of Southern California, not everybody knew that there was an admissions scandal. Or at Penn State, not everybody knew that there was sexual abuse going on. And those scandals did tremendous damage to those institutions. So the question is, how can the board gain a greater awareness of the risks that are being faced by the institution?
Yeah, it's a great question, especially now, right? Because one of the things that's happened with the technology we have, with social media, is as the president or the head of a system, there's almost no time when you'll be the first person to know about the bad thing that just exploded on your campus or in your system. Because it happens and people go right on social media and hundreds of students know before you hear about it, what happened very often. So we're living in that kind of 24-hour news cycle, and with all the social media communication we have, it's so rapid that you really can't get out ahead of a crisis in the way you'd like to. But I'd say two things. One is having a really good risk management plan, which is never going to work perfectly. That's not the word. But having one that you think is really good, that you've worked through with your president, with your commissioner, and when the big crisis hits, you won't be the first people to hear about it, but you'll have a plan in place that says, okay, when this kind of crisis hits, here's what the president does, here's what the commissioner does, here's what the vice president for finance does, here's what the board chair does, here's what the chair of the audit committee does. So people can move into action in a way that's coordinated and sensible given their various responsibilities. So having a good risk management plan is really, really essential. And there was one other thing I was going to say about this, and it slipped my mind. Maybe we'll come back to it. But I agree. We all, that's, you know, it does keep you up at night, and you see the damage that has been done to some really fine institutions because some people are doing bad things in some corner of it and they don't get stopped in a way that they should have been. You know, we had, when I was in Wisconsin, we had 182,000 students in the system. We had 43,000 employees. And I'd say to people sometimes when they get critical about a bad thing that had happened, say, when you have that many people, and you know, it's 182,000 students, 43,000 employees spread on 26 campuses, you think there aren't all the time some people doing bad things? Every day there are some people doing bad things. When I was in SUNY, SUNY has 64 campuses, 400,000 students, one governing board, one chancellor for the whole system. So I think you know, having a plan, a good plan that you're all satisfied with, knowing it won't work perfectly in any situation, having with your CEO, you know, as much of a no surprises agreement as you can is great. And then when the crisis hits and you try to put your plan into play, keep in mind the philosopher Mike Tyson's line, everybody has a plan until you get hit in the face. Other questions? Do these generally make sense as hallmarks? Did I leave any? is there a burning one that you'd say, boy, you didn't talk about this and that, any good board needs to do this or have this to be good? Is there anything like that that comes to mind? Right, well, let's move into management and governance, and we'll, strands of this conversation will continue as we talk about this. And this is, you know, the sort of perennial, evergreen discussion for boards and chief executives and leadership teams. What should the board be doing? What should the CEO and the leadership team be doing? And we have in the next couple slides some questions that are examples of management questions versus governance questions, management issues versus governance issues. And some of them are kind of cute and funny, and we can have some fun with that. And let me say, there's that invisible line right down the middle between the two columns can and will shift sometimes. That is, you know, back to the previous question, if you're in a huge crisis around your athletics, are the board members going to need to be asking much more detailed questions about athletics at that moment than they normally would if that big crisis wasn't going on? Yeah. So I don't mean to say that these are hard and fast lines. These are sort of general divisions, but the line is wavy, and even the wavy line may shift to the right or the left depending on what's going on in your system or at your institution at any one time. So let's start with the first two in management. What do we pay our teachers? Who got a raise this year? Will you hire my brother-in-law is a really good one, but we won't go to that one. You know, those aren't bad questions. You'd say, well, trustees should know who got a raise or, you know, what we pay our faculty. Hopefully you do. But I think the question there is, the issue there is for trustees, the bigger kinds of questions revolve around how do we pay our faculty? What sort of performance evaluation systems do we use to decide what we pay our faculty, right? And if you look over on the right-hand column, that's kind of, the right-hand column, that's kind of there. Do we have a compensation philosophy? How is the resulting policy administered? The question of what's the philosophy is certainly a board question. And the question of do we have a policy that's effectively administering or leading to the effective administration of that philosophy in this particular case? Certainly a board kind of question. And, you know, that those questions can lead to discussions around, well, do we have brackets for various levels of the faculty, an assistant professor, is it, you know, lowest salary is this, the highest is this, midpoint is that. Do we compare those to our peers who have similar faculty? Who are our peers? Are the comparisons the right ones? Is our policy in Utah to be at or below or above where the peers are in those brackets? We've had some shifting discussions about that in Wisconsin, about where we want to be. Those kinds of questions that revolve around the philosophy and the policies are the board questions, the governance questions. The more, again, with these titles of management and governance, you can think of the more transactional, operational aspects of your institution, and then the more on the governance, the more strategic aspects. And the board wants to be over on that strategic side. Some other questions. How many gallons of gas do we use? What's our kilowatt hour rate? Do we have low flush toilets? Again, on the governance side, tell me about our emergency management policies. And how do we know that they result in prudent use of energy? That how do we know question is an important one. And it leads to the issue of, well, do we have in the institution performance indicators or metrics that let us know that that's working? What are they? Are they the right ones? Do we have enough of them? Do we have too many of them? Do we need a dashboard versus 140? Because if we have 140, we don't pay attention to any of them. Those kinds of questions can be very good and helpful for a board to get into. And by the way, I should give them credit. These questions come from Texas State Technical College in 2016. But I think they're fun to go through and think a little bit about the two kinds of work What is enrollment in this program? How many recruiters do we have? How many dual credit classes did we teach? Again, the questions on the governance side different. And there's a key word there. Some of these words will keep popping up on the governance side. Third bullet down, a couple words in. How do we assess the viability of our programs? It's the board's role to be assessing viability with working with, obviously, your president and your commissioner, their team who set up the assessment systems. But it's your job to ask, well, are they working? How are you doing with them? Do they ask that the right things be assessed when we're thinking about salaries or energy use or whatever the topic is? And then how's the bottom question under governance, how's our growth compared to the state rates and to the growth in our local high school graduation rates, and we're thinking about recruiters, et cetera. And that compared word is really an interesting one. I mentioned that earlier in relation to comparing salaries at different institutions, peer institutions. And this goes to the issue of boards with the help of the president and commissioner and their staffs knowing some things about higher ed outside of the institution, right? Because you really do need to know to be able to compare how your institution's doing with comparable institutions. So looking for your leadership to bring you some knowledge about what the landscape looks like around the country and similar institutions to yours is really, really important. And, you know, that's part of the fun, I think, of doing this, is you realize pretty quickly when you do that, well, your reaction can be either, this is a total mess across the country, or, wow, there's all sorts of diversity in the way higher education operates in the United States, and probably both are true in some sense. So why is the grass so tall? Can we please paint the boardroom? How much will we raise our tuition rates? Let's talk about tuition because it's a perennial hot and difficult topic. It's certainly fair, right, for boards to ask about raising tuition and know about what the plans are. The boards need to approve it at some level, and you have some, I think, divided responsibility maybe between your two levels here. But I think the point here is that the board should make its decision on tuition rates, whatever it is for your particular board, only after it tackles the sorts of governance questions listed on the right-hand side. And if you look particularly the last three bullets on the right-hand side, how does our revenue mix compare to our peer institutions? You know, in higher ed, we're a peculiarly funded entity where you have state money, you have federal money, you have tuition, you have fees from the students, you have private donations, you have contracts that may help to fund research or other things. So that mix and how tuition fits in the mix and how you compare in that to your peers is really an important thing for boards to ask. Again, what's our long-term dependence on tuition? What are the alternatives we could consider? You know, there's a lot of talk now, right, about the model for financing American higher education is broken. And it's not going to take us into the next 10 or 20 years where we need to go. The state governments have been disinvesting by and large. Tuitions, in part, as a result, have been going up right at the time where we're saying we need to have more Americans get into a college program and get through and graduate with a credential. If we're going to be globally competitive and secure in this, you know, really competitive global knowledge economy that we're in now. So we've got these vectors going in different directions. Higher tuition, and we want more people to come and pay the higher tuition, but more and more of them can't. So there's lots of talk that the board needs to be involved in, and this plays out very differently institution to institution. And by the way, it's never enough, I guess, but I was happy to see that you're evidently still about 50% funded through the state. Your tuition is still relatively low by comparison. So you're in a better position, I think, to lead on some of these big national things than some other states. So good for Utah in that regard. I think the thing about alternatives is an important word, too, for governors. So, one thing that I would do sometimes, which which turned out to be a pretty good discussion framer at board meetings, was to say, okay, we got this issue. The board has to make some decision on it. Here are three alternatives. You could choose among these three about what you need to do, what decision you need to make on this issue. And often when I did that, I would say at some point, usually open it up and have people talk, but I would say at some point, well, here's my preferred alternative. Let me tell you why. And I think this one has more strengths than weaknesses, and that's why we should do it. The other two have some strengths, but I think the weaknesses in the other two outweigh them. But that would be an opportunity for the board then to engage in a kind of serious discussion with some information on possible ways of going at it. So looking to have those kinds of discussions about alternatives to what you're doing now or to what you might see yourself doing in the future is really, really important. And of course, your own student body's sensitivity to tuition increases and how we know about that. So one of the interesting things about being the head of a system is you have institutions, at least if you're like Wisconsin, where you have student bodies that are relatively wealthy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You have student bodies at institutions like Parkside, UW-Parkside, UW-Platteville, that are relatively poor. And this discussion around how you handle tuition in a system needs to take all those different kinds of students and their sensitivities, their family sensitivities to tuition into consideration. Why didn't we name Smith as our starting pitcher last night? What's the theme of the awards banquet? What's the gross margin of the bookstore? The board version of that first question, one of them is, well, what do we know about graduation and placement rates of our student athletes compared with the rest of the student body, and why? And one of the interesting things about that, I don't know how it works in Utah, but when we would look at that, even among our Division I schools, and we had schools in different divisions in the system, athletic divisions, NCAA divisions, if you took the athletes as a whole, the intercollegiate athletes as a whole, their retention and graduation rates were higher than the rest of the student body. Now, if you took men's basketball and football, that was not true, right? So one of the interesting things, if you have, for the institutions that have big athletics, is to have these kinds of conversations. And this is, back to risk management, obviously this is an area where if you're not paying attention, you can all of a sudden find yourself in very deep, deep doo-doo. One of the things that we did after Penn State was we decided for our Division I institutions every year, the chancellor of the institution and the athletic director would come before the full Board of Regents and talk about all the NCAA regulations that they were dealing with, if there were violations in the last year, how they responded to them, what the graduation rates were like and placement rates and retention rates for their athletes. So that forced it up into public, and I think, you know, given some of the problems we've had with athletics and continue to, that kind of thing is a good thing for boards to do and not worry about who the starting pitcher or who the starting quarterback is. Now, I can tell you there are still some schools, some big prestigious universities where board members, from my taste, are way too deep in the athletics program because that's what they're really interested in, right? They want to talk to the coach and they want to send in plays in the third quarter if the team's behind, and they want to do all that kind of, and you know, the rest of the board, if you have situations like that, needs to say, that's not your role. We know you're interested. You can be a fan, you know, be a good fan, but stay out of the middle of those kinds of management decisions. Okay. Second question there, what could the board do to improve the level of donations made to the college? I think that's another one of those thread words that boards need to have in mind in all of your overview areas. How can we improve? What are we doing to try to improve? What do we know about what it takes to improve? Are there some areas where we think we really have a shot at it, others where it's just, you know, too far to really put a lot of resources into? When you think about that improvement line, all those other questions kind of kind of pop up. And again, in terms of where you want the institution to be in 10 or 20 years, how you can, as part of your legacy, when you step off the board, say, well, I helped improve this part of what Southern Utah University does during my tenure on the board. Then you say, well, good tenure, right? I did a good thing. When can we start the anthropology program? Some of my family members are into yoga. Could you start a course? What good is a course in James Joyce? On the other hand, what are the major strategies contained in our academic plan, and how is progress going? That's the big picture. How is the plan enabled or constrained by our facilities, by our staffing levels? So tying together the core academic operation to the facilities where it mostly takes place, to the budgets and to the staffing that's under each of them. Those are legitimate areas for the board to be thinking about and talking to the president or chancellor about. And then the final question on the right side, how often do we measure that? How are we measuring that? That measure question, really important for board members to keep in mind. And then if you ask all those questions on the right-hand column, you'll know if you'll be able to have the facilities to do hot and cold yoga. Back to the question on the other side. So before we go on, I'm going to stop and see if the management governance conversation resonates. Anybody disagree with any of the things that were on the left-hand side, thinks they should have been on the right-hand side, or on the right-hand side, thinks they should have been on the left-hand side? Again, they're not hard and fast. So you have what was occurring to me when I looked at your structure, where the Board of Regents has seven members who were trustees at the institutions. You have, and this is a good thing about your structure, you have people on the system-wide board, the big board, that has a deeper understanding of the institutions that the board is overseeing. And in that sense, you bring those of you who are on or are regents now but have been trustees at the institutions in the system, bring a sense of the operation and management of those institutions to the big board. And that's really an advantage, I think. It's not that then you want to get into managing or remanaging the institution, but you can say to your fellow board members and to the commissioner, well, wait a minute, that Utah Valley, it doesn't really work that way. Or if the big board did this, Utah State would have a problem for these reasons. I think that's good. And so in that sense, knowing you're a big board, as I'm calling it, the system-wide board, may know more about the operations and management than a lot of system-wide boards do, which can be a weakness on some of the system-wide boards, which is part of the reason we had that region buddy thing, where we had to send that system region out and get to know that campus a little better. We didn't have the advantage you have, of, for the most part, of having people who are on any kind of institutional boards be on the Board of Regents in Wisconsin. Yes?
We have some legislators here today. Can you speak to the, you mentioned the assemblyman.
Speaker.
Talk a little about relationships between legislators.
Talk a little about the relationship between legislators, governor, and public higher education.
Yeah. So the question was, talk a little bit about the relationship between legislators, the governor, and higher education. I know there's some legislators, and happy to have them chime in here. And I think a couple things. So, I think higher ed is a victim, if you want to think of it that way, of the larger problem that society is having with severe partisanship. So we're caught in the middle of that crossfire, and lots of other institutions in the society are, and that's part of what's made these jobs a lot harder since that crossfire got a lot more intense. And I think it's not healthy. I think we're all kind of thinking, how do we get out of it? But we've got to work our way through it now. So I think, again, all politics is local, back to Tip O'Neill. And since you do have those trustees on the Regents Board who have been at the campuses locally, hopefully they bring some of that local contact with their local legislators. My experience, even though legislators or the legislature may be criticizing higher education or the system, they like their local campus, right? It's like people saying, well, I hate the Congress, but I love my congressperson. She's really great, but I hate the Congress. So drawing on that strength of the local presence you have on the statewide board is something that I think can be helpful. Before I became the president of the system in Wisconsin, I was the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin Extension, which was the outreach and cooperative extension, and public broadcasting was part of that, small business development. So we, in Wisconsin, Extension operates in all 72 counties, and we had offices. So for 8 years, I was the provost there, for 4 years the chancellor, for eight of Extension. I was out dealing with legislators all over the state all the time, and they loved their local Extension office, and we provided lots of opportunities for receptions and meetings and ribbon cuttings where they could come and be part of what was going on. So I'll be going next week or the week after up to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, where's Liz, to talk to the Chancellor's Community Council, which is about 60 people that they have there that include their local legislators and business leaders who they bring in a couple times a year to advise the chancellor, and they usually bring in some outside speakers. And you know, I would have legislators say to me on both sides of the aisle sometimes, we don't hear from you enough. We only hear from you when there's a crisis or there's a problem or you want money from us. So I think anything in the midst of all this horrible partisanship, anything we in higher ed can do to be communicating, talking more regularly about what's going on locally in that person's district that relates to the university. And it mightn't be that there's a campus there, because there's not a campus in every district, but it might be that there's a farmer there who's used a new technique that one of your campuses developed. It might be there's a new business in that legislator's legislator's district that grew out of some research that one of your universities did, and maybe the person who's running it now in that legislator's district is a local gal or guy. I think we have to look a lot more at those kinds of home opportunities with local legislators than we have in the past. But let me open it up. I know, again, we have legislators here who know a lot more about this than I do. Any other thoughts on that question? Okay. All right. We still have a little time. Any other comments, disagreements? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the Guardians Project and advocacy. And this is, you can see the title here, Reclaiming the Public Trust. So this project really grew out of a sense that AGB had, which was based in some real fact, that there was a lot of criticism, growing criticism in the media about higher ed, about not only the way it operates, but its value proposition, right? Is it worth it? Costs more? Do you get a job when you get out? Or is everybody who gets that degree living in their parents' basement, working at Starbucks as a barista, putting off marriage, house buying, and all good things that citizens want to do because you can't get a job after you've spent all that money on higher education? And as a result, there have been, if you look at surveys or polls or headlines, a fair amount of negative noise about higher ed out there. And the one that was most striking to me was a Pew Research poll taken in, it was either 2018 or 2017, that said this in that survey. 61% of Americans say the higher education system in the United States is going in the wrong direction. 61% of Americans said the higher education system in the country is going in the wrong direction. When they broke it up by party affiliation, 73% of Republicans and Republican-leaning respondents said that, going in the wrong direction. 52% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning respondents said it's going in the wrong direction. Now, let me. That's an extreme result, and let me hasten to add that that poll was done right after the big free speech controversies at Berkeley and at Middlebury in Vermont, and it was a really hot topic. And again, back to what we were saying about free speech, that just sort of spilled over, I think, Americans' attitude generally about higher education. But that, it's not people saying it's not having the effect we want. It's saying it's taking the country in the wrong direction. That's awfully, awfully strong. Now, there, when these polls get taken, makes a huge difference on what the answers look like. How the questions are asked, we all know, makes a huge difference. But there is enough of, and I won't go through them all today because we don't have time, but enough negative stuff out there in polls that AGB started to worry. And then let me just read you a couple higher ed headlines from last August. So these are from August 2018, all in the month of August. Market Watch said, graduates spent nearly $7.5 billion on education that failed to deliver. The New York Times said, the student debt problem is worse than we imagined. Headline from the Chronicle of Higher Education, sports scandals soil the land grant legacy. From Bloomberg, Bloomberg News, student loans are starting to bite the economy. From Forbes, hiring is on the rise, but are college grads prepared for the world of work? All those headlines in major media outlets in August of 2018. And by the way, that so this was a year ago. This was before the big college admissions scandal that sucked all the air out of the news about higher ed in recent months, right? Now, at the same time, there have been polls where the results have been quite positive. And I can go through those, but I won't. But I think you know they're there. So I'm trying to make you feel bad, not good, so I can get you more interested in advocacy. But they are there. But the weight of these negative stories had gotten to the point where AGB said, what can we do about this? So they started to think, could we, in addition to the already heavy burden on people like you to be fiduciaries of your own institutions or systems, could we have some step forward as advocates for the value proposition and the overall contributions of higher education to the quality of life for individuals, to the economy, for our states, and for our country? And, you know, we know when we look at the facts, the positive benefits of higher education are huge in terms of higher salaries, longer lives, less contact with the criminal justice system, better health, more volunteering, more civic engagement, all sorts of positives for the individual and the communities where they live, the states where they live. But they felt, well, that story is not getting out very well. Well, who could help us do that, they thought. I didn't know this number till I started working some with AGB. So they estimate that there are 50,000 trustees, regents around the country, 50,000 Americans doing what you all are doing in Utah. That's public, private, you know, the smallest two-year college to the biggest R1 university. And some of the private universities, if you know, have 50 or 60 people on their boards, mainly for fundraising reasons. But that's an astounding number of people. And I'm going to build your egos a little bit now by saying, what do we know about those 50,000 people? Well, you know, they're kind of VIPs, you all are. You know, you get on these boards. The governor appoints you because you've come to the governor's attention in a positive way. In some other states, boards are elected. They run and get elected by the people in their district. The Nevada System Board, I did some work with them recently, they have, I think it's 13 regents. They're all elected by district. No at-large seats. So it's like having a second legislature commissioner. You could have two of them if you had a fully elected board. But whether election or appointment, and most people are appointed, you are prominent citizens, and you are in networks, professional, personal, social, church networks, where your voice is listened to, probably, right? You're in a time of real partisan divide. Our trustees at our colleges and universities are Republicans, they're Democrats, and they're independents. We cross those divides among those 50 30,000 people. And another unique thing that you are is you are people who know more about us in higher ed than anybody else who's not us. In this society, you do, and you bring a credibility with that knowledge to speak about the value of higher education that we don't bring, because those of us who take paychecks from a higher ed institution to say nice things about it, you know, that kind of cuts back on your credibility. So you can be that loving critic with that credibility and say, you know, not everything goes real well at the University of Wisconsin. Here are some things I think they're doing poorly, and we're working with President Riley on this to fix it. Let me tell you how we're working to fix it. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's talk about all the good things that the institution I govern is doing in your district or your region of the state and for the state as a whole. And when you say that with an independent credibility that we don't have. So the question was, can we help engage the trustees to help turn that negative narrative, given the kind of people they are and the place they have in the society? So we started to work slowly, but it's ramped up some. It's kind of retail work. You work with an individual president, chancellor, commissioner, and with a board member he or she designates to get out in public in some way and talk about the value proposition, talk about the good stuff that's going on at Southern Utah University that the public doesn't know about, right, by and large. So these are just examples of people who've written op-eds in papers to talk about it. Dennis Fitzsimons, who's a trustee at Northwestern, is a former president of the Tribune Company. Richard Riley, many of you know, is the former governor of South Carolina, and he was also the Secretary of Education in the Clinton administration, and he's a trustee at Furman. Deborah Mayores, who's a trustee of Westminster College, published her piece in the Cincinnati Inquirer, where she now lives. She's now the head counsel for Procter & Gamble, and she was the chair of the Federal Trade Commission under George W. Bush when he was president, and Robert Levy in the Louisiana Board of Regents. So having op-eds out there is one way to help influence this. And there are other ways too. Let me mention some of those, because it's not just about newspapers, because you know nobody under 40 reads newspapers now, right? So we want to get at other means. So there, the campaign is working on other communications vehicles. Videos, we've got a great video now with Norm Augustine, who was a member of the Board of Regents for the University System of Maryland, former chairman of Lockheed Martin, and a very big proponent of higher ed. He did a great job on that video. We've helped people prepare speeches to go to their local chamber of commerce or their optimist club to talk about the value of their institution, of the system. And let me say in all of this, to comfort you presidents in the room, I already said this to the commissioner, AGB works very carefully with the president. This isn't about going around the president to go to your board members and pull people out and divert them into doing something at the national level. The idea here is how can we work together locally and nationally through and with the presidents to do this. And let me say, you know, not every board member is going to want to do this. Not every board member is going to have the time to do this. Not every board member would be good at doing this. You know, we all have our gifts, and some board members are a lot better at one piece of board membering than they are at other. This is a unique set of skills, but lots of our board members, by virtue of their characteristics, which I went through, have those skills. So we also have podcasts, radio interviews. We have a trusteeship radio that we've put up. We've done these sprint campaigns on Twitter, sending out data on various topics in higher ed to trustees who are involved so they can feel comfortable in talking about those issues with the hard data backing them up. And a bedrock of this, kind of where it got started, was a series of briefing statements, which are available on the AGB website. All of this is available. That talk about major issues or challenges in higher ed. One, for instance, on the business model. There's one on the return on investment. There's one on innovation in higher education. One we're working on now on international higher education. one on civic value, civic learning in higher education. So the idea with those is to have, you know, 12-page, fairly short briefs that have a good executive summary that if you're going to go talk to your local chamber of commerce about the return on investment, you can pull that out and look down a page and have three or four really well-researched metrics about the value that you can use in that talk. And if you get challenged, you can say, no, wait a minute, I can tell you this is factual. Here's what this means. And, you know, part of what hasn't happened, I think, is we haven't tried to support our trustees like this because so many of you are so busy and you're accomplished people in your own professions and you don't want to get out in public and look dumb, right? Look like, well, I really don't know higher ed. They're going to send me out in front of, you know, 250 people for the Commerce Club lunch and I'm going to be fumbling all around. We can help you get ready to do that if that's what you want to do through a number of these things that I've just been describing. Let me just give you a couple examples of how it's played out locally. So in my own institution, I work with my successor and the new chair of the Board of Regents there. So they did a Board of Regents meeting session where they had three topics, one after the other. The first one was it's every 2 years I think they do it now, their economic impact statement. They bring in an outside firm that analyzes the economic impact of the university system on the state in a variety of areas, and then they put out a report and they do a big board presentation on it. They had that session. That got followed by a discussion of guardians and board advocacy. Two of the chancellors we worked with, and they talked about this project and what they hoped the Board of Regents in Wisconsin would be able to do with it. And then the current board president, we call him the president there or the chair, and the board vice president spoke and said, yeah, this is a good idea. We want the board to really be out there advocating for the University of Wisconsin in this next biennial budget. And then the third piece at that meeting was the discussion and approval of the biennial budget for the board, for the university system. So they yoked those three things together with this guardians advocacy idea in the middle of it. Good and smart thing to do. And Widener University and the Philly Chamber of Commerce, another kind of place that's picked this up. And maybe this is more relevant in some ways as you think about what you could do here. So Philadelphia has talked about, we want to be a guardian city. What does that mean? Well, they have what they call a President's Alliance, which is the college and university presidents in the tri-state area there. So they've got Southern New Jersey, Philadelphia area, and Delaware. And they meet regularly with the leadership of their Chamber of Commerce, which is also a tri-state Chamber of Commerce. And one of the things they started to realize was, wow, we've got just a lot of colleges and universities, big, small, public, private, in this area. And we ought to be talking about that as a way of keeping businesses here who want to grow and attracting businesses to the Philly area who might want to start here, with the notion that the universities and community colleges and four-year colleges are all in this President's Alliance working with the Chamber. And if you want to grow your company here, you want to come here and start a company and grow it, we have, through this large network of colleges and universities, we will help you develop your workforce. We'll get what your people need through the colleges and universities in terms of training and development. So they are now working hard on that. And one of the interesting things is that a number of the people who are prominent in the chamber, both on the staff and on the board of the chamber, are themselves board members at colleges and universities, right? Not surprising. The chair of the chamber board, or the chief executive of the Philadelphia Chamber, is the chair of the board at Ursinus College, which is a small private college in the Philly area. So he really gets this. You can think of it as a way for trustees to step up and help advertise, advocate for, talk about the strength of both the higher ed and business communities in places around the state together. Interesting way to approach it. And then the final one I'll mention is Oregon State University Foundation. So Of course, more and more of all of you have foundations, right? Raising money, private foundations with some connections, helping institutions to raise money. And AGB estimates that there are now something close to 40,000 people who are on foundation boards for universities and colleges. That's in addition to the 50,000 who are on governing boards. So, and that's been, you know, that's been a change in the last 20, 30 years with so many more of our institutions having to raise money, especially in the public sector, and having vibrant foundations and foundation board members. So in Oregon, their foundation started to think, well, what if we tried to have our foundation board members do some of this public advocacy for Oregon State University? After all, a lot of these people on these foundation boards have put their money where their mouth is, right? They're on the foundation board because they made a significant contribution to the university through the foundation. So they believe in it at some level. So they started something, their nickname is the Beavers, and they started something called the Beaver Advocates, I think it's called. And so they have actually gotten their foundation board members involved in all sorts of ways throughout the state of Oregon, advocating for what Oregon State does. So those are three different ways that the project has been used locally to the advantage of the local institution, city, state. This is just a list of how you might want to find out more, or ways you might be able to find out more about the Guardians Project. If you just go to the basic AGB website, you can do it, find out more. So my proposition to you is, if we have presidents and the commissioner here who are thinking of a board member or two that they have that might be good at this, that might want to do this, get in touch with me and we'll help try to develop what you want to do. And then, excuse me, we'll be happy to feature what you're doing on as part of this national project on the AGB website, and when you go around and talk with conferences about it, at conferences about it. So the whole idea here is to build a cadre of concerned, informed citizens who are trustees. You're concerned, you're interested, you're also informed to talk about the positive value of higher education in the country. And I think this is important because, you know, I think we know, don't we, that if you don't have some kind of post-secondary credential in the 21st century, you're not going to be able to live a very good life for most of us after all that's said and done. And that doesn't mean we trip over our own language here a lot, right? Where people say, well, not everybody needs to go to college. Well, that's right. But usually when we're saying that, we're thinking of a four-year college or a university. Those three kinds of students I mentioned, that student who wants to go back and get a certificate or associate degree to go into the computer gaming industry is going to college, and he's getting what he might want and need out of it. And if he works doing that for 10 years and wants to go into management in that field himself, maybe he'll come back and get a baccalaureate degree then, if we have the programs fit to do that for him. So I think we need to push back against this notion that not everybody needs college. And I'll just be frank about this. Most of the people I hear saying that, when you look at their own backgrounds and you look at where their children are going to college or have gone to very good colleges and universities. It's the other people's kids who don't need to go to college. That tells you something about the credibility of the argument. So I think the more we can have people like you out there who understand this, talking in public with your fellow citizens about how important this is, with the problems, with the criticisms of higher ed, it's really important that our children, our citizens, have post-secondary education and credentials to be a competitive country in the future. You know, 15, 20 years ago, we had the most highly educated population in the world in terms of people with a post-secondary credential. We've now slipped back to 14th or 15th, the last time I looked at the OECD data. That's a trend that can't abide if we're going to be competitive in the future as a country in this global knowledge economy. And over time, it's not a trend we can abide if we're going to have national security either. So I think there are very, very important stakes here looking out into the future that hopefully we can pull a number of people in Utah in with the help of the commissioner and the president to articulate here in Utah and on the national level. So, Mr. Commissioner, I'm going to stop there, Mr. Chair, and see if there are other questions, comments. And we have, I guess, 12:30 is when it's due to end, so we're a little early. It's about 12:20. Yes, sir.
I've seen a couple of studies recently where a six-year-old child today, they're saying when they go into the workforce, 65 to 70% of the jobs have not been created.
Yeah.
If that's true, that's not very many years away, 14 to 20 years away. How do we as boards adapt and make sure that we're continuing to provide the value of higher education to adapt to those kind of workplace changes?
Great question. Everybody hear that? No? Why don't you repeat it, because you've got the mic now. And just
okay.
Yeah.
I've seen a couple of studies recently where a six-year-old child today, when they enter the workforce, 65 to 70% of the jobs that they will go into have not been created yet. And that, I think, puts an even heavier burden on all of us, whether we're management or boards, to adapt and to continue to provide the value of higher education to meet those needs of those careers. And any suggestions?
It's a great question. It's the big kind of workforce development question, right? What's higher ed's role in workforce development? And there are a lot of ironies in it. And I like to say, look, if you look back 20, 25 years ago, companies that employ hundreds of thousands of Americans right now didn't exist. Google didn't exist. Microsoft just got started about 25 years ago. Facebook. I mean, you can go on and on with new technology companies that weren't around 20 or 25 years ago. So this gets into the debate between the liberal arts and the practical arts. You know, should you study accounting? Should you study technology? Or should you get a degree in English or history? And I think the thing we have to keep in mind is that our obligation in higher ed, your obligation as board members, is to see we're doing this, is we've got to prepare the workforce for the jobs that are there now and for the jobs that haven't been invented yet, where many of our graduates will spend most of their working years working, and we don't know what they are. Some of them are in industries that haven't been invented yet. How do we do that? Well, I think we work closely with businesses and employers about the jobs that are out there now and how we can contribute to producing what they need. And we can't do all of that. And you know, some community colleges and technical colleges and others will do some of that. Other places that are not colleges will do some of that. But we have a huge role there. We shouldn't shun it or shirk it. And on the other hand, we have a role to say, look, if you got somebody who's interested in studying history or English, great, do it. Because what the business leadership tells us when we talk to them about this is, you know, the people I hire in my corporation who ascend to leadership in it are people who are literate, can speak persuasively, can write clearly, are numerate, understand something about technology, can work in diverse groups, understand international affairs at some level, because, by the way, I've got, five offices in five other countries around the world. And a lot of that is what we hope, get out of a good liberal arts education. And so, in a sense, those people who right now are studying the liberal arts are preparing to work in some of those companies that don't exist yet. And they mightn't go out and get a job right away. Some of them might, you know, maybe they're going to work at Starbucks for a year. But over time, what the studies show is they catch up in terms of salaries and the rest. And then longer term, in terms of leadership positions in the society, very often those people who have liberal arts and sciences education ascend to those positions. Now, you know, this is all, everything you say is wrong, and you can contextualize it and say, well, wait a minute, isn't it true? But generally, I think that's the answer. So we have to prepare, again, the workforce that's needed now and the workforce of the future. It can't be one or the other. We shouldn't be trying to say everybody ought to do this, everybody ought to do that. And a big part of this, I think, is for those who are preparing for the jobs now with associate degrees in technology, let's say, engineering technology, we have to be sure we have crafted programs that if they want to go on later to a baccalaureate degree, they can. So one fun thing I did when I was president to get at that was in northeastern Wisconsin. We had Northeast Wisconsin Technical College, and we set up an agreement between our two four-year campuses up there, the UW-Green Bay and UW-Oshkosh campuses, that they would accept an associate degree in technology coming out of the technical college. And unlike your situation here, the technical colleges in Wisconsin do offer credit, and they do offer degrees. And so those two four-year campuses said, we'll accept that as a major at UW-Green Bay and UW-Oshkosh as a tech major, and we'll have you do your general education, your liberal arts and sciences in the junior and senior years, and you'll get a baccalaureate degree. And some of the companies there were saying, we need more people now to rise from the lower level tech jobs up into management and leadership, and they can't do it because they don't have a baccalaureate degree. We want them to have that. And you know, this was, as you can imagine, this was not an easy conversation with the faculty. But ironically, I'm a displaced English faculty member, and I've had English faculty members at those two institutions say to me, I love this. Why? Well, we now have 35-year-olds who've been out working in the world, have lived enough of life to come back and are really interested in learning how to write. It's not the 17-year-old, you know, as a displaced English professor who's taught a lot of freshman English, who comes in and says, why do I have to take this freshman English course? I don't want to do it. I hate writing these essays. So they get students who are really interested. They're interested in the wider world, and they like, enjoy taking the liberal arts classes, and having them in those classes makes those classes richer for the 17 and 18-year-olds and 20-year-olds who have come right out of high school. So that's an example of the kind of thing we need to do. One other thing on this, which is just a little funny story. I was talking to one of the big business association heads in Wisconsin about this issue not long ago. And he said, you know, there are two abilities that every employer in Wisconsin I talk to says they want in people they're looking to hire. I said, yeah, what are they, Paul? The ability to pass a drug test and the ability to use an alarm clock. And we can't do a whole lot about either of those very effective. Yes, yes, ma'am. One of the two of you, or both of you.
Thank you, Dr. Riley. Sure. That was very fascinating. I appreciate what you said about the need to educate the public about the value of higher education. I was a public opinion researcher for many, many years and learned how disconnected many of our people feel to higher education. I think that is one of our big problems, is helping to connect them to higher ed. And I was thinking about the many graduations that I have attended, especially since my stint here, and I can't help but think, even though I may not know any of those graduates personally, I still have the same feeling when I watch those students, those graduates, cross the stage. Yeah. And I'm just wondering how we capture that same emotional feeling among our citizens. And it made me think of a study that I had done probably 20 years ago for the Deseret Industries. And it was the most popular ad that I'd ever tested as a qualitative researcher. And it was called The Little White Dress. And it took, it had a photo, it had a video of a mother and her little girl, about 7 years old, who had grown out of this little white dress. It was very special to her. And you could see her making the decision about to give this dress up. And it followed this little white dress throughout the whole course that it went through. And then the final frame showed a little girl in Jamaica wearing this little white dress on the back of a wagon. And I think it worked because it connected the things that were important to some people. And I'm just wondering, I'm giving a little strategy here, but I'm just wondering how we get that emotional connection back to the citizens of our state and understanding the value of higher education.
Perfect. And you know, you talked about feelings and emotion. We know that people generally are moved by, make decisions, take actions more on feelings and emotion than on hard, cold facts. And in higher ed, we're really great at producing those facts and reams of sheets and, you know, charts and graphs, and look at this, we can prove to you that. But the general public is not moved by those generally. They're more moved by how do you touch them where they live. So it's very interesting you say that. Early on, somebody said to me, you know what this project needs to do? It needs to bottle the feeling at commencement. Bottle the feeling at commencement. So, you know, another thing that was said to us, which we haven't done enough of, is if you're going to do this, pair a trustee with a junior or senior at the college or university, or a recent graduate, even better, who started into a career and can say, you know, I completed my degree in X at Southern Utah, and now I'm working at Google, and I see a career now because of what I got out of Southern Utah, and have the trustee and the recent grad, or the trustee and the senior talking together about the value of what the senior is getting or the value of what the recent grad got. So, given your individual background, it'd be great if we could get you paired with a student or recent grad at your institution, get a video, get an op-ed, get some kind of statement out there in public, just of the kind that you said. And it's hard, you know, when you put an individual student's face to this, like you do at graduation when they're, I've been at so many graduations, I don't care to count them, but you just watch them all moving across and they're all smiling and happy. How do you bottle that? How do we get that out to the general public? You're exactly right. So maybe you could help us. Now, is there another question over here? The gentleman in the blue and white shirt? Oh, you were pointing. Okay. You tell me when time's up. Time's up. Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot. Great working with you. Good luck.
Thank you very, very much, Dr. Riley. That was just fabulous. We really appreciate your coming out and being with us. We have lunch available out just out here in the corridor, and buffet, bring it back in here. Again, spread out, no more than two regents at a table, trustees spread out with others from other institutions, et cetera. So grab some lunch. We'll start again here in half an hour.